We better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Scenes like that one from Back to the Future have inspired an entire generation to wonder when they'll get a flying car, let alone one that time travels. We're definitely far from the souped-up DeLorean of film history, but what do we have to look forward to? Joining us now by phone to talk about where car design is going is the head of GM's Advanced Design Department, Clay Dean. Welcome to the show, Clay.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
And for our listeners, I have this question. What would you most like to see in a future car? Give us a call. Tell us, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and maybe Clay Dean can tell you, or maybe one of our other guests coming up. Clay, in your job, you work with concepts and technologies the rest of us probably haven't imagined yet. How far ahead do you look in what you do?
That's a great question. I think, when we talk about advanced design, that suggests something pretty far out in the future. Even when we talk about production design, so here at the Tech Center in Warren, Michigan, we have our production studios, which are working on the next generation cars. They're literally 5 years ahead of where we are today. So if I walked you down the hallway to our design studios, you would be walking in to look at a 2017 Chevrolet Equinox as a full-size model today. So that's 5 years from now, and that's the next stuff we're working on. So my team, where we have global studios, we are 10 years and further is where we're looking. So about two generations away from now is where we're spending our time and focus.
We all know that energy efficiency is the most important long-term advancement in most things. So let's tackle that first. What are the potentials for the near future, say by 2050 or so?
Well, 2050, that's huge.
I think to look way ahead.
Yeah, you're way out there.
All right, let's say 10 or 20 years ahead then.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of folks, when they think about advanced, they are looking for the time travel machine, right? And surely that's just right around the corner. But when we think 50 years back, you know, from where we are today, I mean, 50 years ago was 1960. You know, it's not that big of a change from where we are today. So how different have cars changed? They're a little smaller. They're a lot more efficient, and they're primarily gasoline engine cars and diesels. I think when we look about 10 or 20 years from now, the things that we can envision that are going to be really, truly real is I think the electric car is going to continue to be a bigger story because it's only going to get more and more and more efficient. And I think technology is going to make that something more desirable with more range and lower cost. And I think in certain instances around the cities, it's really going to be a good story. I think you're still going to see cars with gasoline engines. Because I think they are going to get more and more and more efficient. I mean, we're looking at cars with gasoline engines that are they'll be getting 50, 60, and 70 miles per gallon. They're going to have to with government requirements. And then more importantly, they're going to be very clean. So there's the fuel efficiency side, but there's also the pollution side because we want a better quality of life. But I do think we're going to continue to see trucks because we build things here in America and we have to haul things and we do recreation. So I think we're going to see evolution of some of the things we see today. But I think probably one of the more exciting things and something that my team is working on pretty aggressively is we're really trying to study it's kind of a generic term, which is urban mobility. So as people continue to come back to the cities and live in the cities, what type of transportation devices do they really need? And that's where we may see some real new types of inventions.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Clay Dean. He's the head of global advanced design at General Motors. We're talking about the cars of the future. If you have a question or comment, want to tell us what you want in the future, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The urban mobility concept. So it's possible that car companies like yours could move away from what we traditionally think of as a car and think more in terms of transportation in general.
Absolutely. So you think about it, one of the things that we've been challenging our leadership is we keep thinking of ourselves as a car company. We're a transportation company. And so people need to go places. They need to do things. So if we kind of kind of address a whole new paradigm. So what does it take to move people efficiently and quickly and in a wonderful state? And is a car always going to be necessary? And that's a really provocative question here at a car company. But quite honestly, we almost need to be thinking on that leading edge to make sure that we're anticipating what customers are going to look for and what they're going to need in these new city centers and cities of tomorrow. So it could very well be something that isn't a traditional car as we envision it today.
Ed in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air with Clay Dean, and you're asking a question I'd like to ask, so go for it.
Well, hey, mine was about more smaller cars, and it fits right into his urban concept he just mentioned. Great show, by the way, but I'd like to see something like the ultimate commuter, something like a small car that would come with an integrated or, you know, optional trailer if I want to go get groceries or go somewhere. But I just don't see enough market for small cars with high mileage, you know, and it doesn't have to be fancy because I think commuter is where we can save the money on gas in this country. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I would. I think one of the things that we've spent a lot of time in the last couple of years with my team is that we've been going on what we call expeditions to cities all around the world and asking and observing what are people doing, how do they use cars, and the type of vehicle you're talking about, there's a desire for it. Something that's simple, something that's dependable, reliable, really efficient, that is flexible. And I think, you know, there are trends that are telling us that a vehicle like this is going to be more in demand as we move forward. So I can't confirm or deny that we're working on something like that, but I would tell you that we're spending a lot of thinking time on it.
Thanks a lot, Ed, for that. I guess where I was going with that was a small car that has enough power to pull a trailer, not one of these big honking trailers, but something that you can go camping with. Because that, well, in the future doesn't look very likely if the price of gas keeps going up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have to – there's so many different needs because we have such a diverse society with, mm-hmm. with people's wants and expectations. And we have to really – you know, I think in the past, because everybody would own one car or two cars, you almost had to overbuy. You would get something that maybe is more than you really need because you want to make sure that it's flexible for the unexpected use. And I think in the future, we might see a different focus where you might have a very efficient vehicle that you can run around day to day, and you might have another vehicle that's maybe more universal sized. It's interesting when you talk to people and you really observe, 85% of the time, the vehicles in America on use on the road have one person in them, 85% of the time. So that tells you that we can probably be a little more efficient, and maybe the type of car that we create, you know, back to, I think it was Ed's comment, something that's not really expensive, something that's very efficient to just be flexible for my day-to-day use. There might be a place that this is a third vehicle or something else that you would use.
When you're in the process of design, is it pretty much about function and the design comes after? How much, you know, a lot of the advertising that most of us, many of us grew up with was all about how sleek it looked and what it looked like and, you know, all of that space age stuff from the 50s and the 60s and then moving into the 70s and 80s, it was mostly about looks. How much do you think about that now?
It still is important. You know, appearance is really important because we like to say in design that what we do, we create stories. And so if somebody has a red car or a black car or a yellow car, just the color itself says something. You know, either I'm an introvert, I'm a show-off, or I'm flashy, right? And so design is important, or styling is important. We kind of view that as a superficial word because it assumes that we didn't think of the whole thing through. But I think you have to think of the vehicle from the inside out. How does it fit people? How can they utilize it inside? You know, what are the, how much can I see out? And so what you want to do is you start from the inside. We call it the architecture. And to make sure that this vehicle is really usable. I can get in and out of it. I have enough room to do the things I want to do. And then what you hope to do is you can proportionally then move outside. You still want it desirable. You still want it to be appealing, mm-hmm. but you can't just start from the outside and then compromise all the use. Today's customer really wants something that's really usable and comfortable because you live inside the car, you know, 100% of the time. You don't, you look at it when you walk up to it, but you have to be able to use it from the inside out.
Jimmy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I have a question. With the success of the Camaro, is there any idea or talk about bringing in any of the older cars, like an older Corvette or 55 Chevy or 57 Chevy that are so iconic?
You know, that's a really good question, and we talk about that a lot. And in a lot of places around in around, you know, consumer products, if you will, furniture, watches, apparel, shoes, vintage is really cool. And it's I have brand new pairs of 1972 Nike tennis shoes because they're just a doggone cool looking design. I think if we put it out there, a lot of people would say, raise their hands and say, I'd buy a brand new 1955 Chevrolet. But things have changed. And as much as we would like to do that, between safety regulations and functional issues, I don't think you probably ever see it. We are inspired by what those vehicles have done in the past. We did, my team did a bunch of cars, concept cars this last year, they were focused really at young rear-wheel drive small cars that were lightweight, that were inspired by Chevy Novas and Chevelles of the past. So we're inspired by our legacy. And we think that there's some just awesome history of things that we've done. But we think we have to be very, very careful about being retro. And we have to kind of we need to create tomorrow's legends at the same time respecting the great things we've done in the past.
Thanks a lot, Jimmy, for that call. What about safety? That's one thing you didn't mention earlier. It was safety. Cars are much safer now. Is it just because of seatbelts or is there more to it than that?
Oh, there's so much more. I think safety is the underlying component about how everything is developed today. So we have obviously you have seatbelts, you have airbags throughout the car. I mean, some of our cars have upwards of 20 airbags inside. But just the core structure and how our engineers are configuring the cars, the types of materials they use. When you can run a car into a wall at 30 or 45 miles an hour and you can get out with no injury, that's a pretty spectacular occurrence. And so the cars are so much safer today, and they will continue to be more so going forward in the future. It's an underlying component. It's the foundation that we build on as we use on functionality. Safety is really number one.
My guest is Clay Dean. He's the head of Global Advanced Design at General Motors. We're going to continue our conversation with Clay Dean on this show about the car of the future. If you have an idea for a car of the future, if there's something you'd like to see, why don't you give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your comment or your question there. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
For this car, a sturdy, lightweight, non-corrosive metal body is desired, and titanium, a new wonder metal, is used. But styling is more than just a matter of pleasing lines, pretty colors, and a dash of chrome. It takes careful arranging to integrate the power plant chassis and body. Primarily, the passengers must be made comfortable in attractive seats, for the Firebird must look as well as perform like a car of the future. And now to give the first breath of life to this experimental car.
Okay, welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was the fantasy in the 1950s, the Firebird concept car with a titanium body, side retractable headlights. Those were the coolest things. And a body shaped like a rocket, the interior designed like a living room. We're talking about those faraway fantasies today and about what's ahead in car design. Still with us, Clay Dean, head of GM's Advanced Design Department. Clay, once again, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
And joining us now by phone as well is Jason Torchinsky. He's senior writer and artist for the automotive blog Jalopnik. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Jason, what examples are there of retro designs showing up in today's models? Clay Dean and I were talking about that earlier, how they are inspired by what was hot in the past. What do we see today now?
Well, there's actually a number of different kinds of retro design. And I personally think we lump all retro designs together, and maybe there's actually more to it than that. There's a number of cars that we all are familiar with that are here in the U.S. that we would consider retro, at least in is like the more derivative kinds of retro that are directly related to an older car, like the VW New Beetle, the Fiat 500, the version we have now, the Mini. Those were all based on design templates that were established long ago. In the case of the Beetle, as long as the late 30s, the Mini from the early 60s, and the 500 from the same era. So you've got some that are like, let's recreate an iconic car from the past with a modern design vocabulary. And then we've got some where it's not a specific car, but they're going for more a general kind of feel. Things like the PT Cruiser, the HHR, remember the old, that last Plymouth, the Prowler, all have designs that are designed to kind of evoke ideas without specifically targeting one particular car. And their design vocabulary, meaning the actual bits and pieces, is kind of modernized. And then there's a final category, which is, you know, cars that are designed to feel very much like they were from the past. And even the vocabulary of things they're using, chrome bumpers, chrome trim, certain types of lights, is retro. It's like very old school type design. Japan does this a lot. They made a car called the Figaro, which feels just like a 60s era little roadster. Daihatsu makes these all kinds of little cars that look like dead ringers for the original Mini's little brother. So there's actually a lot of different retro cars that you could find globally around there now.
Claydene, are you still looking for something that will be iconic in the future, something new that we'll always remember? And maybe 50 years or 60 years from now, they'll be thinking about redoing that someday?
Oh, sure. I think every designer is trying to accomplish that. I think, we joke a lot that when the new Camaro, for instance, is a great car. It's fantastic. Everybody loves it. It really inspires the 69, 68 Camaro. And so internally we joke, so is the next Camaro we do going to look like the 1970 Camaro? Or do we need to create something all new? Because back then, every Camaro, every generation of Camaro, and there were four of them, each one was new. It was a new statement. Every generation of a Corvette, we've just launched a new Corvette, the seventh generation of Corvettes in 60 years. Everyone was not an evolution, but it was a new statement, a new vision of tomorrow. I think there's a component of us that, as designers, that love that opportunity to invent and to move forward, and instead of evolution. But, part of my role is we have done concept cars. In fact, in just about 3 weeks, we're going to debut a new concept car out in California at Pebble Beach, and it's a Cadillac. We're excited about it. When we do cars for that event, yeah, that's an event that celebrates car design for the last 100 years, beautiful, elegant, exquisite, spectacular cars. And when we approach the concepts to design for that event, the challenge we put to our designers is 50 years from now, will people look at what we're doing and give it the same reverence of these cars that we see from the 20s and the 30s at Pebble Beach? So we truly want to create something new that hasn't been seen before, and try to elicit that same emotion or desire or love that people are showing for cars, that are 40, 50, 60, 70 years old. It's kind of our duty to do that. If we don't want to get caught up in just revisiting the past, we want to showcase what's tomorrow.
Anthony in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I know about 5 or so years ago, Honda came out with the Clarity that runs on compressed hydrogen. And I've been wondering why there hasn't been more of a push towards that. And if there is that somewhere in the near future? And if not, what is the apprehension with making cars that run on compressed hydrogen?
Good question. I think we're always exploring those types of technologies. We did a concept called the Autonomy, which was also a hydrogen-powered car. And there's a whole group within our R&D group that is working on this. But they're really expensive. And the expense has to be brought down to a level that most of the public could really afford.
There's also one other huge issue, and that's the infrastructure. We have mechanisms in place for distributing and selling gas right now. Selling and distributing hydrogen and storing it safely is a very different prospect. So the infrastructure to where you actually go to fill your hydrogen car, it's one of those chicken and egg problems that we have for all kinds of things, where nobody's going to buy a lot of hydrogen cars until there's an easy way for them to get them refilled, and no one's going to build a lot of refilling stations until there's enough hydrogen cars to support it. So the infrastructure is, I'm sure, an issue as well when it comes to the acceptance of these things.
Kind of the same problem they're having with electric cars, right?
Very similar, yeah.
It is, but if you look at some, you know, Tesla, for instance, to speak of the enemy, they're actually creating their own infrastructure. And so if you wait, when you think about the gasoline and the distribution strategy there, it took, you had a very small infrastructure of automobiles, but it took about 20 years to actually get gasoline distribution throughout the United States. Tesla has just said, we're gonna create our own infrastructure to enable our own car. So it's a very noble, very brave activity, and you have to applaud them for putting the effort forth. And so they're systematically, very strategically building that infrastructure. And it probably will lay the foundation for more things. I think infrastructure is everything to make these cars work. So the new technologies have to be thought about that. Even diesel, just availability of diesel across our country isn't as prolific as you would imagine in certain places.
There's also a conceptual issue of hydrogen has over electricity, and that nobody has all these memories of a big German electric blimp blowing up. So that's a factor as well.
The old Hindenburg, right.
Yeah.
Email from a listener. I would love to see cars that have a magnetic zone around them to buffer them from getting too close to each other so they could not collide or follow each other too close, which is an interesting. And this listener also says a car that would not start if the driver has too high of an alcohol content. Two very different things. What about that magnetic zone?
Well, you know that kind of already exists, but it's not magnetic. With the they have these systems to keep you in your lane, and they have systems that actively adapt the cruise control so you don't get too close to a car.
Uh-huh.
So instead of a magnetic buffer, there's computers that are basically just keeping you from making terrible decisions. And go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there.
Sure, Clay Dean.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, you're exactly right. You know, what we can actually call it the crashless car. So and using the same systems that you're talking about, what our goal is instead of trying to put all extra airbags and all these other things, if I can make the car stop or avoid obstacles around you, I'm never going to hit anything. And there are systems that are really doable today that we can program that. And so we're very advanced in developing what we would call the crashless car. In fact, when we talk about autonomous, which may be something you talk about, autonomous, one of the components of autonomous driving is a crashless car that will avoid other cars, it'll avoid walls and obstacles, and it'll keep you safe. And
are you meaning like a self-driving car?
Well, yeah, autonomous means self-driving, but the crashless car means you're still in control, and it would actually, if you do something, it won't let you do something dumb. It'll actually compensate and stop you from doing something wrong. And that's where we're headed towards right now.
What about the issue of cars that won't start if the driver has too high of an alcohol content?
They already have things that the cops even make you plug in if you have for certain kinds of DUI offenses, you actually have to blow into before it'll let the car start. I think that exists.
So
they could put one on their car right now, I believe.
Right. The technology exists, but is it something, Clay Dean, you see becoming part of the package down the road? No pun intended.
I think you could. I think, you know, any of those types of devices that promote safety and that usability, absolutely. I think it is completely doable right now.
Nobody would want to buy that for their car, though, I don't think.
Except somebody who's buying
order that on the option list.
Except for somebody who's buying a car for their kid.
Absolutely.
I suppose, but yeah.
You don't have kids yet, right?
No, I do. I have a 2-year-old, but I don't let him drive that much. And his drinking is under control.
All right. Okay, Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Fred.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning. I'm in my late 60s, and I've been through this conversation in the 1960s, early 70s. I saw the turbine car. We had fuel cell electric car prototypes. They were working on the automated car. And then these things sort of fell out. And I'm talking to people, then they were victims of the policies and energy politics and tax policies. So my question is, in the efforts today, what do you think is different today than the dynamics in the 60s and 70s, where we were really supposed to be doing these things long time before now.
Jason Turchinski?
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, the big thing that's different from now in the 50s and 60s, in terms of the autonomous car, the huge factor is the technology. Computer technology we had then and whatever sensors we had then just wasn't up to the task that computers are today. That was a dream back then, the autonomous car, and there were all kinds of ideas of magnetic guiding and rails and things like that. But there really wasn't the technology to make, you know, autonomous cars then. We had ways of kind of messing with it, but it wasn't going to be there. Also, for a lot of other things, gas was cheap. Gas was cheap in the 50s. There was less pressure to actually make more efficient cars. It was easier for the companies to sell cars with more chrome on them and fancier looks and different ways than to bother with efficiency. And things like the turbine car, that was one of those ideas that was terrific on paper, but it sucked gas. It had these incredibly fast-spinning parts. It didn't offer that much advantage. And there's still turbine cars. Well, you know, you can still see these things in museums, and everybody was making them for a while. Rover had one out in the UK. We had, you know, the US ones. Almost everybody was working with them. But the end result of those was they just didn't pan out the way we thought they did. They were gas-hungry and didn't offer that much advantage. You could just do more with conventional piston engines at the time. So a lot of these things, you know, there was a technological limitation, and some of it was just ideas that sounded terrific, but they just kind of petered out because there wasn't as much point to them. You know, we did explore that stuff, and if it wasn't going to make money for a car company, they're probably not going to bother following it up, and they didn't.
Clay Dean at GM?
I would agree with Jason. I think some of those, we were doing battery cars, we were doing fuel cell development, we were doing Wankel engines, four-rotor engines. Technology wasn't ready then. You know, battery technology has moved dramatically since the late 60s and early 70s. We have several electric cars up in our Heritage Center that we were just looking at last week. So we've learned a lot and we've progressed further. And quite honestly, the other big push today is government regulation and requirements are a lot more aggressive today than they were back then. Back then it was suggestion. Now it's mandate. And so it's going to force us to do some things. But technology is still the hurdle, and affordability is a challenge. You know, we do need to make money, and that's what allows us to continue making great new product for people. And so and the customers have to respond to it. And I think customers, they have affordability, you know, tolerance that they can only afford so much. That we need to make sure that we're responsible providing them the vehicles that are really efficient, that they can actually engage with. So we're going to get there. It's just going to take some time. But we're still working on, you know, fuel cells. We're still working on that. We're going to find that threshold to get better. Electric-powered cars, they're going to get better and more efficient and more affordable. But some of these things just take time.
Thank you, Fred, for that call. Kieran?
Hey, can I ask if there was an electric Chevette in your Heritage collection? I remember seeing something about that as a kid. I'm just curious.
We don't have the Chevette up here, but we have Corvairs and Corvans and Chevy vans that are all electric, so we have those.
Oh, that's great.
Karen in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Karen.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. Listen, I'd like to address the experts on the line, and I was so pleased to hear the positivity in their early talking about, you know, challenging car companies about what is transportation, what is it, how does it work, and looking at it in a more efficient sort of future-looking way. And what I'd like to do is ask them to push the envelope a little more because I feel like everything we're asking for, which is environmental friendliness, which is safety and efficiency, already exists. And it's called a train. It's called mass transportation. It's called high-speed rail. And I'm certainly not blaming you for the sins of your forefathers, but it was the car industry that eviscerated our ability in the U.S. to have real public transportation. So I want to ask them about the fact that I would love to see a car company step up to the plate and say, it isn't about more and more and more different kinds of individual cars. It's about how do we create a system that truly is efficient and that every city has an option for, that's private and clean and as wonderful an experience as a car.
Clay Dean at GM, what do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question.
It is.
I would heartily agree. I think you don't need a car all the time. There are 26 cities in America right now that are aggressively developing their new streetcar systems and light rail. And so you're seeing cities reinvent themselves with mass transportation. And as part of our study going forward, we think that that probably has to be a cornerstone. When we look inside the cities, efficient trains, efficient light rail, efficient streetcars, subways, bike lanes, walking lanes, and other types of things, it's going to be key to the redevelopment of the city.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I mean, when I think about that kind of idea that Karen brought up, I think about how trains can use and work with the automotive industry in being able to, like when you were talking about smaller vehicles, is there a way to transport vehicles via train so that when you get to the city, you have your urban vehicle? But right now, you're stuck in the urban center with that at this point.
You need to come to the New York Auto Show in 2014 to see a vision of what we're going to show.
Okay.
There are some, you're onto something very smart right there, because I think the key for us in the future is how do we interact with the systems that cities and states already have? Mm-hmm. How do we magnify the systems that are there? Because people live in the suburbs and they have to get to the city. And so how do they get to the city? And how do we make sure, because cities don't want cars parking on their streets. They want the streets to be livable, wonderful spaces. They want the congestion and the noise to go down. But we still need to get to the cities. And we call it first mile, last mile syndrome. And how do we, because the reality is everybody doesn't live in the city and people have different ways of getting to and fro. And different dynamics. How you address transportation in New York is very different than how you address it in the suburbs of Los Angeles. And so we need to have something that is actually applicable and flexible. And what's interesting is the suburbs of Los Angeles are very similar to the suburbs in the periphery of Paris and their transportation challenges. So your idea, though, of how do you engage the personal use vehicle, and I'm not saying how big it is, mm-hmm. but along with trains and other types of systems, there's a way for that to happen. And that's part of, we're spending time with city planners, metro planners, transit planners to find this sense of cooperation that as they envision their cities 20 and 30 and 40 years from now, how do we engage with them to help create that vision and actually accomplish it? So I think you're onto something exactly right. And it's kind of exciting that you brought it up, because it's right in sync with some of that work that we're doing in our advanced team right now.
Well, Claydene, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun talking about this.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk. It's, you know, designing cars is my business, and we could talk the rest of the day.
Exactly.
And I could talk to you off. But it's always exciting. It's exciting for us to hear that people are still interested and motivated about the car. And so we look forward to things we can entertain them with.
Claydene, he's head of global advanced design at General Motors. And Jason Torchinsky, thank you as well for joining us today.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. One quick thing for the previous question that came in, because I think she asked why these things aren't happening. And just to be slightly cynical, you're not going to make the same kind of money selling, you know, rail systems as you are selling individual people, individual cars. And I think that's a factor. Car companies, you know, you can't blame them. They want to make money.
Yeah.
And that's their job. Their job is to make individual cars. Plus, there's a factor where I do love public transport systems. I think they're extremely important, but I can't imagine giving up the ability for personal transportation. I can't imagine not having my own independent car, both because I love driving for its own sake, and just the freedom it offers is not trivial. You can't, I don't think people, especially in a country as large as ours, are ever going to entirely give up the ability to move about completely independently. Whether they work that in with public transportation here and there, or there's some combined systems like Clay was discussing, I think is great and probably absolutely will happen. But the absolute elimination of the car in favor of public transport, I don't think is going to happen. And it's not even something I want to see happen.
Okay. All right, Jason Torchinsky, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jason is the senior writer and artist for the automotive blog Jalopnik. We have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check it out. Thanks to Karen for that last question. We appreciate it. Coming up, we're going to talk about a car that had a future and then sort of flopped, but still has a pretty big following. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For those among us reared with the Jetsons Saturday morning style fantasy of cities in the sky and jetpacks and flying cars, the 21st century so far has been a bit disappointing. Those fantasies pretty much have flopped. But wait, there's still the Amphicar, which will be on view at the upcoming Salina Lake Festival. For more information, you can check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. The festival will showcase one of the car industry's forgotten fantasies, a swimming car known as the Amphicar, attracting collectors and fans from around the country. Joining us today to talk about the Amphicar is Chad Parsons, longtime enthusiast and member of the International Amphicar Owners Club. Welcome to the show, Chad.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It has been called one of the 50 worst cars of all times, and that seems really mean to me. Tell us where the Amphicar came from and, you know, what the dream was.
Well, the Amphicars were made originally in East Germany back in 61 to 68. It was made by Hans Trippel, is the guy that came up with the idea for it. And, you know, the fact that it was one of the 50 worst cars, probably one of the 50 worst cars and worst boats.
On both scores, right?
Yeah, they kind of left it out on the list there, I think.
Chad, I'm going to have to interrupt you and ask you if you could just pull your mouth a little bit away from the speaker on your phone.
Oh, yeah, not a problem.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. So what went wrong?
Well, the reason that they weren't able to continue with them is the increasing regulations that were coming from the government for both land and boat. The Amphicar has to have everything that a boat has and everything that a car has. And they just really couldn't keep up with everything and still make it an enjoyable vehicle.
My guest is Chad Parsons. He's a member of the International Amphicar Owners Club. They'll be in Salina, Ohio, in a few weeks. If you want to learn more about that, go to WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Chad Parsons, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Have you ever seen an Amphicar? Give us a call and tell us what you thought of it. So how many models were built, and how many models were there? I guess how many models and how many were built?
Well, there was only one type that was built. It was called the 1147 or the Amphicar 770. They called it the 770 because it goes 7 on water and 70 on land. There were approximately 3,600 of them built. And today there are probably a little over 600 left that are even around that we know about.
Are all of them usable?
I would say not. Usable, I'd say that's probably closer to about 300 or so.
Could you describe what they look like for someone who's never seen them?
Well, we often get like a 50s Chevy. Is what a lot of people think of it when they see it. It's got the big fins in the back, and it's all one-piece body. It's all 100% steel. And, it's really a interesting thing because you can't really describe it other than it looks like an old 50s car.
Where are the little rotary paddly things? Where are those? There's a technical term for that, right?
Yeah, the propellers.
Okay.
The propellers are in the rear of the car. It's got twin propellers in the back, and they are located in the back underneath of the engine. And the engine is in the rear, and it's a rear-wheel drive car. And it runs off of two transmissions that are kind of combined into one. And they're actually Porsche transmissions that were put into them.
These, you said earlier, they're German design, right?
Correct.
Did they come before or after? That was post-World War II, right?
Yes, it was 1961 to 1968 is when they were produced.
So what's it like to drive one into the water?
It's a lot of fun, honestly. Get a lot of looks, and my favorite thing to do is just to drive about 30 miles an hour into the water yelling no brakes when people are on the dock.
So you go off a dock, or do you go in by way of shoreline?
You can do either. Anywhere you can go, as long as there's a gradual grade, where you're not going to hit your propellers going in, you can pretty much go in anywhere.
And what's the gas mileage like?
We actually get about 30 miles a gallon in them when we're driving on land, and the manual says it gets about 1 hour per gallon on water. So it's actually really good gas mileage.
Carl, in Columbus, you're on the air with Chad Parsons of the International Amphicar Owners Club. Welcome, Carl.
Hi. A friend of mine, an optometry student named Jim Bihari, bought one with his excess student loan money as an investment and rebuilt it. The best description of its appearance would be like a 57 DeSoto. It had tail fins, that straight tail fins, not curved like a Plymouth, but straight line up to the rear. And it had twin propellers, but it had no rudder. The steering was accomplished very crudely by turning the front wheels.
Yep. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, that is correct. The front wheels are your rudders. They act as rudders for the front, and it turns very, very slowly.
All right, Carl. Did he make good on his investment, Carl?
As far as I know, yes. The value, he got it for something down around $10,000 with some defects, and he put another 5 or 10 into refinishing it. So I think he came out okay in the end. He may still have it. I haven't talked to him in a year.
Chad Parsons, how much are the cars worth if they're working and so forth?
Well, they range in value. I mean, they've gone at Barrett Jackson, they've gone all the way over $100,000.
Wow.
But that's if they're in mint condition and, you know, everything's 100% on them. For a restorable car, you're probably looking around $20,000. For a fully restored, probably now around $30,000 to $40,000.
What got you interested in them?
Well, my dad actually, I've been around them since I was 9 years old. My dad bought one. He found a random one in a barn. He said, "We're going to go buy an Amphicar." I said, "Okay, what in the world is that?" Like, it's a boat and a car. And we just found it out in the barn, and ever since then, we've both been very interested in them. My dad has a few of them, and I have one myself.
And do you tinker with it and work on it and that kind of a thing?
All the time.
Do they break easily?
It's not that they break easily, it's that they're an old car. Okay. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's always something that you have to fix on it. And it's also a boat. So as most people know, a boat is a money pit. And it's no different than with an Amphicar.
It has a bilge and that sort of thing?
Yes, it does. I have two bilge pumps in mine.
did it come with two, or did you add an extra?
I added a secondary. And I'm glad that I did, because I almost sunk mine last year, actually, at Salina.
Now, Salina has this gathering every year.
Correct. We do it with the Lake Festival there every year. We've been doing it for years. We've been there for probably about 15 years now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we just started it. My father, actually, and the current president at the time, were looking for a new location that was a little bit closer to them to hold a new national club meet, because it was in New York at the time. So we decided to try out Salina and see if everybody would come, and it actually turned out to be a very central location for everybody in the country.
And what do you just hang out and float around in the lake?
Yeah, pretty much. There's parades that the cars go through. There's, like, on Friday night, there will be an event called the Splashing at the Hot Hole. That's where all the cars line up. We meet up and we all line up about 35 cars to 45 cars every year that show up. We've had all the way up to 60 cars before. And we will go into a big parade through all the crowd and do a big splash in with all the cars at once and drive around the lake for everybody.
Do you give people rides?
Yeah, we do rides. There are members that give rides, and we just kind of drive around and have fun and let people enjoy the cars. Because that's really what it's about for us.
Can you still get parts for these things?
Yeah, you can. There's a gentleman named Hugh Gordon that purchased out most of the existing inventory from Amphicar when it went under, and he's found parts and has created new parts since then. He's based out of California, and he's the main manufacturer and distributor for all the Amphicar parts. And there's also other gentlemen that have created aftermarket parts for the Amphicar as well.
So do they come to the Salina event every year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they it's a big event. They have the gentleman from California brings out a trailer full of all his parts that we can buy and sell, and we have a big swap meet there on Saturday mornings as well.
What wears out the fastest?
Oh, that's a good question. It's probably the steel on the car itself.
Okay.
The water and steel tend not to mix very well. So they weren't very – they're very ambitious with that idea. We get a lot of rust spots, and the gaskets and stuff like that are – they tend to deteriorate over time, so you have to replace those.
Okay. Carrie, in Columbus, you're on the air with Chad Parsons of the International Amphicar Owners Club. Welcome.
Welcome. I saw a car like that in the movie The President's Analyst in the 60s, and I don't know if that was true, if that was just a set, something from the set.
I do not know about The President's Analyst. I do know that it was in Pontiac Moon, that car with Ted Danson was in. It was in that movie. And also another one, Cotton Pickin' Chicken Pickers.
Now, I understand that Lyndon Johnson owned one.
Yes, he did.
Any other famous owners?
There have been. I can't remember off the top of my head right now, honestly. I think Ted Danson still owns one.
Okay.
But there are quite a few of them that have owned them over the years. I do know Alan Jackson had received one for a couple years ago as a gift for one of his tours that he did.
Okay. Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. So the Salina event, does it cost money? I mean, I'm sure it costs or something to get a ride and that sort of a thing, but otherwise it's free to everybody who goes there.
You know, most of the time we try to give out rides for free. We don't really like to charge a lot of people at the club.
Okay.
Because what it is it's bringing attention to the, you know, the older cars and letting people just enjoy it and say, hey, I got a ride in an Amphicar.
And you said you had a couple. How big is the color scheme? Do you change the paint on them, or is that original paint and keeping it as original as possible important to owners of Amphicars?
You know, it really depends on the owner. Myself, I have a color custom color scheme on mine. But if somebody else, they are more an original. It's just like any car, really.
Right. Some of them get souped up and messed around with, and others are into the authenticity. Well, Chad Parsons, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad I got a chance to talk about it.
And once again, the Salina Lake Festival is coming up next week in Salina, Ohio. We have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about it. But it will feature an Amphicar swim-in and a cruise-in with, you said, usually get around 60 cars, right?
This year it's probably going to be closer to about 30 to 40 cars.
Okay. All right. Thanks again. And a special thanks to Emmanuel Joschi, who produced this show today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.